thank you for joining us for Talking Sleep, a podcast of the American Academy of Sleep Medicine. I'm your host, Dr. Seema Khosla, Medical Director of the North Dakota Center for Sleep in Fargo. The world of sleep medicine has had several large recent disruptions with COVID-19 and the Philips Respironics recall, but these haven't been the only ones. If we look back almost a decade now, sleep medicine was disrupted by the SERVE-HF results and the field safety notice for ResMed ASV devices. Interim data from their ongoing trial identified a signal linking the use of the device with death in those with primary central sleep apnea and an ejection fraction of 45% or below. We as clinicians had to quickly identify those at-risk patients and determine an alternate treatment or at least have a conversation where they were informed of the potential risks. Although the SERVE-HF trial was conducted using the ResMed Minute Ventilation ASV devices, Philips also supported the decision and both companies provided similar guidance. Another trial was conducted around the same time as SERVE-HF but utilized the Philips ASV devices. Those results have now been published and provide some insight into the use of peak flow triggered ASV for those with an ejection fraction of 45% or below. Dr. Douglas Bradley is here to share his results and to offer his thoughts on the use of ASV. He is a professor of medicine and he runs the sleep research program at the University Health Network in Toronto, Ontario. Thank you for joining us today.
It's my pleasure. Thank you for having me.
So I'm wondering if we could briefly revisit SERVE-HF.
Certainly. Well, SERVE-HF is the largest randomized trial involving patients with heart failure and a reduced ejection fraction below 45% and with primary central sleep apnea. They used the minute ventilation trigger device made by ResMed at that time, and they recruited 1,325 patients that were randomized to either a control group or to a group who received the ASV device, and followed them up for around 5 years. What they found was that the primary endpoint, which included all-cause mortality, hospitalizations for exacerbations of heart failure, resuscitated cardiac arrest as a composite endpoint, they found that there was no significant difference between the two groups, although the hazard ratio was in favor of the control group. However, when they looked at all-cause mortality and cardiovascular mortality, there was a significant increase in mortality in both those arms with the use of minute ventilation triggered ASV. And the hazard ratios were quite high, 1.24 and 1.34. So there was a very significant increase in risk for death on the device.
And they died during the day though, right?
Yes, primarily, the increased mortality was related to sudden death. And most patients were not dying at home. They were dying outside of the home. So it was during the daytime, meaning mm-hmm. that they weren't dying when they were on their devices. So important secondary endpoints that they looked at included quality of life measures. So they looked at the Minnesota Living with Heart Failure Questionnaire. They looked at the Epworth Sleepiness Score. They looked at a New York Heart Association class. And they also looked at sleep structure. And in none of those was there an improvement. And in particular, there was no change in total sleep time, no change in sleep efficiency, no change in sleep stage distribution, no change in arousal frequency. There was no significant difference in the Minnesota Living with Heart Failure Questionnaire, the Epworth Sleepiness Score, or the New York Heart Association class. So they had no effect on hard cardiovascular outcomes and no effect on quality of life, both from the cardiovascular and from the sleep side. So it was very disappointing to many of us that this trial ended up being negative.
So now that leads us into your trial. Tell us about the ADVENT-HF trial.
Okay, well, the ADVENT-HF trial was different from SERVE in that we included both patients with obstructive and central sleep apnea because we know both those disorders are common in patients with heart failure. We included patients who were 18 years of age or older, men or women. And similar to SERVE, they had to have an ejection fraction of 45% or less. And they also had to have an apnea hypopnea index of 15 or greater. So they had to have moderate to severe sleep apnea. They were stratified into those with mainly obstructive and into those mainly with central sleep apnea, and then were randomized either to the control group or to a group who received the peak flow triggered ASV made by Philips. They were then followed up for a maximum of 5 years for the primary endpoint, which was the composite of all-cause mortality plus cardiovascular hospitalizations, new onset atrial fibrillation requiring anticoagulation, and an appropriate ICD shock for cardiac arrhythmia. So over the course of the trial, the average follow-up time was 3.6 years. And in terms of the primary endpoint, there was no significant difference among the groups for that endpoint. However, there was also no significant difference in all-cause mortality or in cardiovascular mortality between the two. However, if you examine the curves for mortality, all-cause mortality, in the central group, there is a divergence between the two groups favoring the peak flow ASV-treated group with a hazard ratio of 0.74 and a p-value of 0.25, so it wasn't significant. Nevertheless, what this meant was that the device that we used appeared to be safe, unlike the device used in the SERVE trial, which ended up causing increased mortality. We did not see that at all. In fact, we had almost the opposite effect, although it wasn't statistically significant. The other important difference was that we saw very significant improvements in sleep structure. So, of course, the apnea-hypopnea index was maintained below 5 per hour throughout the trial in both the OSA and the CSA group, compared to 7 per hour in the SERVE trial. So our device actually controlled the sleep apnea better. Same with the 3% oxygen desaturation index. It went way down. The mean oxygen saturation and the minimum oxygen saturation went up significantly in the ASV peak flow group. In terms of the actual sleep structure, the frequency of arousals dropped significantly in the ASV peak flow treated group. And that was accompanied by a significant decrease in stage one sleep by 18 minutes and a significant improvement in stage three sleep by 10 minutes and a 10-minute increase in rapid eye movement sleep, all of which were highly significant at the P less than 0.001 level. So as you might anticipate, if sleep structure improved, you might expect an improvement in quality of life. And indeed, that's what we saw. So in terms of the Minnesota Living with Heart Failure questionnaire, there was a significant improvement for all patients randomized to peak flow ASV, as well as to the subgroup with OSA and the subgroup with CSA. And there was a tendency for the improvement to be greater in the group with CSA. And we see that throughout the trial, that the improvements we see tend to be greater in the CSA group than the OSA group. Similarly, with the upper sleepiness score, although it was within the normal range between 6 and 7, it did drop significantly for the whole group and for the subgroup with OSA and for the subgroup with CSA. And again, it was a tendency for the CSA group to have a greater drop. In terms of New York Heart Association class, there was a significant improvement compared to the control group at 1 year and 2 years after randomization for the whole group. We didn't see that in the OSA group, though. There was no significant improvement in the New York Heart Association class. However, in the central group, we also saw a significant improvement at 2 years and a borderline significant improvement at 1 year. So these are very much in contrast to the SERVE trial, where they saw no improvements in any of these factors.
So talk to me like I'm a fellow. Explain the difference between the ResMed ASV and the Philips ASV.
Okay. So the ResMed ASV was specifically designed to counteract central sleep apnea in patients with heart failure. It also works in patients who don't have heart failure. The way it works is that they have a default expiratory pressure, or EPAP, of 5 centimeters of water and a default pressure support of 3 centimeters of water, which means that during every inspiration, the minimum pressure they get is 8 centimeters of water. Now, you can imagine that might cause you to overventilate a bit. Whereas and it did not have an algorithm for titrating EPAP to counteract obstructive events, okay? So it was specifically designed only for central apnea. Now, they could manually titrate the EPAP to get rid of obstructive events, and that could be done. The Philips device, however, is triggered by peak flow. So when the peak flow drops below a certain level, it triggers an inspiratory pressure support breath. And if they detect that there's upper airway obstruction as well, it triggers an increase in expiratory pressure automatically. So it's designed to treat both obstructive and central apnea. And because we designed the trial to include both types of sleep apnea, we chose the Philips device because it was designed to treat both types. And indeed it did. As I mentioned before, it kept throughout the 5 years, it kept the apnea hypopnea index below 5 throughout the 5 years in both the OSA and the CSA group. So it works extremely well. The default pressures are different too. So the default EPAP was 4 centimeters of water and the default pressure support was 0. So the minimum pressure they would get on an inspiration would be 4, which is half of what it was with the SERV ASV device. Mm. So the devices work quite differently, and the results, I think, are explained by that.
So I heard you say that you were trying to follow people up for 5 years, and then I heard you say average was like 3.6 years. So I imagine you had several hurdles that you had to work through during this trial.
Well, obviously, if you recruit patients over time and the trial ends at a certain point, not everyone's going to reach the 5-year limit. So a combination of things that made the average follow-up 3.6 years. One of them was that patients died, of course, or they had a primary event that that caused a censoring, or they withdrew consent, or they were lost to follow-up. So those were the reasons for the not the full 5-year follow-up. Now, that compares with 2.6 years follow-up in SERV. So we actually had a longer follow-up time, although fewer patients. The number of patients that we randomized included in the intention to treat analysis was 731.
Mm. And then what happened when COVID hit?
Well, it wasn't pleasant. first of all, we most hospitals involved, and there were 49 hospitals in 9 countries, would not allow patients to come in to have their devices checked for compliance and to have their follow-up studies, for example, repeat polysomnograms or repeat echocardiograms or blood tests. So that made it very difficult to follow up patients. And in fact, when the pandemic was announced in March of 2020, we basically could not really get good compliance data from the devices. So the compliance data that we have only goes up to February 28, 2020. The second thing was, of course, because we couldn't do polysomnograms, we couldn't, or echocardiograms, we couldn't recruit patients. So recruitment plummeted. And so that had a dampening effect in trying to reach our sample size. So absolutely, it had a very negative effect on us. The other thing was, of course, some people contracted COVID and a few died from it in the trial.
And then you picked back up. And then what happened when the Philips recall happened?
Well, of course, that happened in 2021, and we had no choice but to stop the trial at that point and inform the patients about this recall notice, and basically told them we had to take them off, and most patients did come off, of course. A few of them refused to give back their machines, but the vast majority, did return their devices, and we had to then destroy them.
Oh, I think that says a lot about how the patients felt about their device if they didn't want to give it up. I mean, I remember when SERV-HF hit, I had, you know, a handful of patients that were like, you know what, I feel better. I get the risk. I hear what you're saying, but I'm going to stick with my machine.
Right. Well, a more, a better example of that is when the SERV-HF safety notice came out.
Yeah. Yeah. I wonder.
That was in 2015, right? And so what happened then is we had to stop recruitment. We had to go back to our research ethics board and tell them about the results and modify the consent form to include these results so patients knew what they were getting into if they signed up. And then we had to re-consent patients who were already on the device and offer them the opportunity to go off. When we did that, there were only 2 patients out of the about 75 patients with central apnea who were on peak flow ASV who gave their machines up. All the rest of them wanted to stay on it because they felt better. And this is borne out by the results that I've just spoken to you about in terms of the improved quality of life and their quality of sleep. So the vast majority of patients on the device refused to go off it.
So you kind of mentioned that there was this sort of split in the data that favored the patients with central sleep apnea. Do you think if you had been able to follow them out longer, you would have seen something?
Well, yes, I do, because you see, the hazard ratio of 0.74 is very close to what we predicted in our sample size estimate. We predicted the hazard ratio 0.775.
Mm.
So it's almost the same. Moreover, the curves are diverging more and more as time goes on. And this is similar to what we saw in the CANPAP trial way back in the early 2000s, where early on there seemed to be a mortality risk associated with using CPAP for central apnea in patients with heart failure. But after a year and a half, they crossed over such that the curves started to diverge in favor of the CPAP group. And that crossover is about the same time as this divergence is occurring here at about 2 years.
Mm.
So there seems to be a pattern of long-term benefit that you don't see necessarily in the first year or two. However, that's all speculation because we didn't reach our sample size calculation, therefore didn't have the power to detect a significant difference.
Mm. So you kind of mentioned a few changes in sleep architecture with, I think you had said 10 minutes more REM and fewer arousals. I mean, what other changes did you see?
Well, as I mentioned before, in association with the reduction in arousals, we saw a marked reduction in stage one sleep. So it went down by 17 or 18 minutes.
Mm-hmm.
And as you know, a lot of stage one sleep is a sign of fragmented sleep. And that basically teeter-tottered to an increase in both stage three sleep of 10 minutes and REM sleep of 10 minutes. So if you think about it, light sleep went down by 20 minutes, and stage three and stage REM, which are the deeper stages of sleep, went up by 20 minutes.
Mm.
So it was like a balancing act. As one end went down, the other one, other end went up. But people would say, oh, that's not such a big change. Well, actually it is, because if you look at the literature, there's no other trial that's shown such a substantial improvement in sleep structure. No other trial in sleep medicine involving patients with sleep apnea has ever shown anything like this. So it's actually quite a dramatic improvement.
Mm. So tell me about how the sleep in somebody with congestive heart failure and obstructive sleep apnea is different for people who have sleep apnea without congestive heart failure.
Yeah, that's a very good question. Well, there's two major differences. So for any level of sleep apnea, if you have no sleep apnea, mild, moderate, or severe, patients with heart failure sleep a full hour to an hour and a half less than the average population with sleep apnea. So that's the first thing, they sleep less. Secondly, for any level of severity of sleep apnea, their Epworth sleepiness scores are lower. So they tend not to be sleepy. And moreover, whereas in the otherwise healthy population, there is a significant correlation between the Epworth sleepiness score and the apnea hypopnea index. In the heart failure population, there is no correlation.
Mm.
So the heart failure population sleeps less and is less sleepy at any given level of sleep apnea. So they're quite a bit different than the general population.
Why do you think that is?
Well, I think there's two main reasons. The first one is that they're sympathetically activated. So heart failure causes activation of the sympathetic nervous system, as you well know. And one of the consequences of that, we think, is that it reduces sleep time. And how does it do that? Well, we did an experiment with my colleague, Dr. Flores, who's a cardiovascular physiologist, and we recorded peroneal nerve activity in the leg, which controls vascular tone and is a reflection of the sympathetic nervous system. And what we showed was that there was an inverse correlation between the sympathetic activity and the Epworth sleepiness score. So in other words, the higher the sympathetic activity, the less sleepy they were. And that's probably because it was a sign of the activation of the reticular activating system, the fight or flight response.
Oh, that makes sense. Yeah.
Yeah. The other thing is that we have shown that patients with heart failure, that their sleep apnea, both obstructive and central, is directly proportional to the amount of fluid shifting out of their legs into their chests and their neck. And we believe that this, I'll call it sloshing of fluid, particularly if it's in the lungs, probably makes them feel uncomfortable. And of course, we well know from many years ago, the descriptions of paroxysmal nocturnal dyspnea is related to fluid shift.
Mm.
And we now see that it's not just related to paroxysmal nocturnal dyspnea, but it's also related to sleep apnea severity. So I think that the excess fluid that they have, that the sympathetic activation is probably the explanation for why they sleep less and why they're not as sleepy.
I love that term, sloshing. That one's going to stay with me for a while.
I thought you might like that.
I do like it. I might have to steal that one from you. So let's take a short break. And when we come back, we'll talk more about the ADVENT-HF trial. You're listening to Talking Sleep from the American Academy of Sleep Medicine.
While attending Sleep 2024, the annual conference for sleep medicine professionals, add these fun activities to your schedule. Join the pack for food and drinks with your peers on Saturday, June 1st at its Lone Star Fiesta. Workout enthusiasts, kick off your morning with yoga, Zumba, and breakfast at Vibe Fusion Fitness on June 2nd. Sunday evening, socialize with food and drinks at Club Hypnos. Register at sleepmeeting.org or on-site when you arrive.
Welcome back to Talking Sleep. We're talking with Dr. Bradley about the ADVENT-HF trial. So you mentioned earlier that the OSA was well treated in your group. How did you do that? Was that all just the device, or did you have to intervene?
That's a great question. Well, the way we looked at it was that not many people had too much experience using ASV of any kind to treat sleep apnea patients with heart failure. And we, having had quite a bit of experience myself, I realized that it's not a black box technology. You can't just give a patient the device, send them home, and hope it's going to work like an auto CPAP. So we realized that we probably would have to adjust in some patients. So what we did is we titrated the device during an overnight polysomnogram. And because we had 49 centers and many of them only recruited, you know, a few patients, we had them all sent electronically to the Toronto Rehab Institute Sleep Lab, where my colleague, Dr. Ryan, and myself read them all. And one of the common problems we saw was that often patients with OSA, the EPAP would not titrate high enough to get rid of the obstruction. And so we would then have to raise the default EPAP. That was the commonest thing we had to do. With respect to the central apneics, sometimes they got what we called closed airway central apneas, which Dr. Sappho and Batter described many years ago. And in those cases, the EPAP wouldn't go up, right? But the IPAP would go to very high levels and often caused very significant mask leak. And so we discovered two things about that. The first is that you do get closed airway central apneas. And to counteract that, you have to raise the EPAP. So that's what we did. And the second thing we found was that we wanted to keep the inspiratory pressure or the pressure support as low as possible in order not to cause a reduction in cardiac output. In other words, best PEEP, right?
Yeah.
We all know from intensive care. And so to do that, we realized that we had to control air leak. So if you have somebody on CPAP, we all know that they can tolerate a certain amount of air leak and still have their apnea controlled. That's not the case with the peak flow ASV. If you have a high air leak, it doesn't work very well.
Right.
So we, whenever we saw this, we made sure that the referring center either changed the mask type or made sure that it fit better. And then we had them repeat the sleep study on the new mask or the new adjustment of the mask. And in every case, when we got the leak down, the apnea disappeared. So those are the two common things we had to adjust, the expiratory pressure and the air leak.
So is that why patients did better, do you think?
I think that's part of it, yes. I think the other part of it is that we mandated the use of a nasal mask initially, whereas in CERV, they mandated the use of a full face mask. The reason we mandated a nasal mask is twofold. First, way back in the 1990s, Neil Douglas's group showed that if you took patients on CPAP, and you randomize them to a night on a nasal, or sorry, to some time on a nasal mask versus time on a full face mask, patients had 1 hour more use of the nasal mask and their apnea hypopnea index was lower. And then we believe the reason for that is when you put on a full face mask, what you're doing is when you tighten the straps up, you push the chin back. And when you do that, of course, you're narrowing the upper airway. You're counteracting the effect of the pressure going through the nose. And in fact, this is why Colin Sullivan had the brilliant idea that you should pressurize the nose.
Right.
So that's why it was called nasal CPAP from the first. And many people ignore that. And what we hear frequently, it's true.
It is
people
true.
People say, oh, I'm a mouth breather. I'm a mouth breather. So automatically you put them on a full face mask. But what you don't realize is that when you put them on a nasal mask, you reduce nasal resistance and they become a
nose breather.
A nose breather.
Yeah, it's my pet peeve. I think we're too quick to put people in full face. It's like the magic word, right? If you just say mouth breather, then boom, you get a full face mask. And so I feel like there's definitely more nuance.
Right. So then in our trial, it ended up that 75% of the people were on a nasal mask or nasal pillows versus 75% on a full face mask in Survey HF. And if you look at the central apneics in our trial compared to the central apneics in the SERVE trial, our patients used their device 20 minutes more, and their apnea hypopnea index was lower. So I believe that our strategy of using the nasal mask was very effective.
So if we can get beyond sort of our world of sleep medicine and maybe, you know, thinking about how you collaborated with your, you know, cardiology colleague, do you think that this trial might impact heart failure treatment guidelines?
Yes, it might. And particularly in Europe, they have quite a strong statement from the European Cardiology Society guidelines, treatment for heart failure with low ejection fraction, that states that if you suspect sleep apnea, you have to perform a full sleep study to determine whether they have obstructive or central apnea. It is allowed to treat obstructive apnea to improve nocturnal hypoxia, but the use of positive airway pressure is contraindicated in patients with central apnea. Okay. Now, to be fair, those guidelines were published before our trial was published.
Right.
And they were based on the results of the SERVE trial, and it certainly made sense at that time. However, I think that the results of our trial say that, first of all, our device, the device we used, works both in obstructive and central apnea, so certainly could be used for obstructive apnea. And second, that we showed that the device is safe for central sleep apnea and actually caused improvement in quality of life. Now, what does that mean? Well, we all know that because of the major advances in drug and device therapy for heart failure, patients are living longer with heart failure than they did before. And what that means is that quality of life becomes more of an issue for them. They're still short of breath. They still don't sleep very well. They're still fatigued. So what we believe is that we're actually addressing the issue of quality of life by treating both obstructive and central apnea and causing an improvement in their quality of life. And so we believe that eventually the guidelines for heart failure, both in the United States and in Europe and also in Canada, will probably could change as a result of the results of our trial.
So it just seems like the timing is terrible though, right? Because this sounds like a very positive finding, and yet this device has been recalled, at least in the U.S. So I don't know, can you get it in Canada?
Yes, we can. Now, the recall, of course, as you know, was due to the deterioration of sound abatement material around the motor. And what they found in experimental animals, at least initially, was that it could cause some forms of cancer. I'm not sure which kinds, but they said, and of course, that scares everybody.
Right.
And so they changed, so they basically had to replace all the machines or change the sound abatement material to one that was proven to be safe. And in Canada, Europe, and Asia, the device that we used is now available with this new sound abatement material with exactly the same algorithm. So
it can be
used in Canada. Yes, it can be used in Canada, Europe, and Asia, but not in the United States. And that has to do with the FDA's, I forget what the exact term that
Yeah,
that
the
is
consent
used.
Decree. Yeah.
This consent decree, yeah.
Yes.
So basically that means that those devices can't be sold in the United States for about 7 years. Now, I'm not sure on the basis upon which that is that decision was made. I just don't know. But my concern is that, first of all, American patients will not have access to a device that we've shown works and improves their quality of life if you have heart failure. And secondly, it markedly reduces competition. So it reduces choice for patients and reduces choice for physicians. And I think it's, you know, I don't know the reason, the full reasoning behind it. So I can't say, you know, to what extent it's justified or not. All I can say is that why is it that we can use it in Canada, Europe, and Asia, and you can't use it in the United States?
Right.
And I don't know the answer to that.
Well, I found it very curious when I read the consent decree and sort of have been speaking with people about it, is that there is sort of this verbiage that says that they will still be able to produce medically necessary devices. And so I guess what I'm wondering is, would this be considered then a medically necessary device?
Well, that's a good question. My interpretation of that is they probably meant ventilators for ICUs.
I think so. I do. I agree. I think so. Yeah. But I'm wondering.
Right. I don't think you could say that in this case in our trial, because we didn't show an improvement in mortality or the primary endpoint. We showed an improvement in quality of life, and I don't think that would fall under that rubric.
So then what other post hoc analyses do you plan to do?
Well, what we're most interested in is to find out in the central group, what were the factors that predicted a better outcome versus a worse outcome? Mm. So in other words, we have a tendency for the hazard ratio to be lower in the peak flow ASV treated group, and the difference is quite big. And what we think is that because we saw this tendency in the central group, but not the obstructive group, and the central group were sicker in terms of their heart failure severity and sicker in terms of their sleep apnea severity, that contrary to what SERV showed, it appears to us that the sickest patients are the one who benefited the most. So we're going to test the hypothesis that the patients with the worst central sleep apnea actually improved the most. And we're developing a protocol to look at that right now. And we think that if that's the case, that would then possibly tell us who would benefit from the point of view of mortality versus those who would not.
So when you mean worse central sleep apnea, do you mean severity of sleep apnea or worse ejection fraction?
Worse central sleep apnea. In other words, worse hypopnea index, more hypoxia. But we're pretty sure that that's also associated with worse heart function. So, for example, the patients with central apnea in our group had a lower left ventricular ejection fraction. They were older, and they had more ischemic heart disease than the patients with obstructive sleep apnea.
Yeah, that makes sense.
So, yeah. And again, as I said, the tendency to improve mortality in the central group was there, but it wasn't in the OSA group. And similarly, as I mentioned before, the improvements in quality of life and sleep structure were also tended to be greater in the central group than the obstructive group. So our basic hypothesis is that the sicker they are, probably the better they would do. Mm. Now, that's contrary to SERV, because in SERV, as you might recall, the patients who had more chain strokes respiration, which they actually didn't define, but which I would imagine meant more hypoxic dips, more apneas and hypopneas, and the group with an ejection fraction of less than 30, and the group with New York Heart Association class 3 and 4 did worse on the amended ventilation triggered ASV than the ones who had ejection fractions of more than 30% were in New York Heart Association class 1 and 2 and who had lower apnea hypopnea index. We're finding basically the opposite. So again, it just shows that the two devices really are quite different and in the way they behave.
So any final thoughts?
Well, it's a shame that we weren't able to get to our sample size. I would hope that we could at some point undertake another trial looking at central apnea with a device similar to ours, but that's unlikely in view of the fact that Philips cannot operate these devices in the United States right now, and that it's going to be difficult to randomize patients knowing that their quality of life is going to improve if you treat them.
Oh, sure. Yes.
It's very unlikely that we can do a similar trial in the future. So unfortunately, I think the sleep world is going to have to make decisions based on the trials that have been done to date, because I just don't think more trials like this are going to be done anytime soon.
That's a really good point.
The other thing, of course, we can hope for is that drug therapies that are in the pipeline right now might work out. But we still have a little while to wait for that. And those drug therapies, of course, are designed to treat the garden variety obstructive group. They're not designed to treat sleep apnea patients with heart failure. So to me, it's going to be many years before the drug story really comes out. The only other thing, of course, is the new class of diabetic drugs, like Ozempic, Would they cause enough weight loss, you know, to cause significant improvements in obstructive apnea? Probably wouldn't affect central apnea, but there's always the hope mm-hmm. that, you know, losing weight and keeping it off and also treating coexisting diabetes will improve sleep apnea to the extent that they get a symptomatic benefit.
Yeah, it's really kind of an exciting time, isn't it, with all these pending potential medications that we might be able to utilize?
Absolutely. And of course, then there's this phrenic nerve stimulation stuff, but they haven't done a large enough trial yet to show that it's really safe in the long term and that it's effective in reducing sleep apnea severity, improving quality of life. That is yet to be seen. But the other thing is that I just want to mention one other thing. One thing I've kind of puzzled with for a while is that phrenic nerve pacemakers have been around for about 60 years.
Right, yes.
But the pacing is done in the neck, which is safer. It's easier to do. And I'm not sure why that hasn't been tried in central apneics rather than doing it through an intravenous catheter.
Oh, that's an interesting thought.
Right? Well, I mean, why wouldn't you do that? It's much simpler. The devices are already on the market. They've been there for 60 years. They're safe. They're effective.
Hey, that's your next trial.
Right. I mean, we have patients in one of our respiratory rehab units who've been on these pacemakers for 30, 40 years.
That's very cool.
Yeah. So I'm just trying to be a bit provocative here.
Well, thank you for joining us today and helping us to better understand how to use ASV in our patients with congestive heart failure.
Thank you very much for having me. It was a pleasure.
Thanks for listening to Talking Sleep, brought to you by the American Academy of Sleep Medicine. For more podcast episodes, please visit our website at aasm.org. You can also subscribe through your favorite podcast service. And if you enjoyed this episode, please take a moment to leave a rating or review. For more feedback or suggestions, email us at podcast@aasm.org. I hope you'll join us again for more Talking Sleep. Until next time, this is Seema Khosla, encouraging you to sleep well so you can live well.